Good evening, everyone. Good evening. My name is Sebo Astanya. I'm the Richard of Anisian Chair in Armenian History, in case some of you don't know me. I'm very happy to host one of our lectures for this quarter today. Our lecturer today is Dr. Vahe Sahakyan. He is currently a lecturer in the Near Eastern Studies Department at the University of Michigan, where he served as a postdoc last year and from where he received his PhD in 2015. Dr. Sahakyan is broadly interested in movements and the circulation of people, resources, and discourses across imperial and transnational boundaries and contexts in the late 19th and 20th centuries. His work places the Armenian experience in a comparative and transnational perspective and highlights the alternative forms of belonging, multiplicity of identities, and discourses on homeland, ethnicity, and nation as they emerge within and beyond imperial and national contexts in the processes of intellectual exchanges, migrations, and diasporization. Alongside his teaching and research, Sahakyan has been involved in various projects promoting Armenian studies in the U.S. and beyond. Between 2009 and 2012, he managed the State of the Armenian Studies project at the University of Michigan under the directorship of Gerard Libarian. In May 2016, in cooperation with the Leipzig Center for History and Culture of East Central Europe, he co-organized an international conference on the modern Armenian diaspora in Leipzig, Germany. As a member of the Society of Armenian Studies Executive Council, SAS, Dr. Sahakyan has been actively involved in the organization of the SAS Annual Conference on Armenians in America, which was hosted in Boston in November of 2016. Most recently, he was invited to serve as one of the two co-editors of the prestigious journal Diaspora, a Journal of Transnational Studies. It's a great pleasure for me to invite Vahe today and to invite him to UCLA because I first met Vahe in 2009 when I was at Michigan and on a Manoogian postdoctoral fellowship. And while teaching a seminar in early modern Armenian history, of which Vahe was a student, and it gives me great pleasure to invite him. Please give me a hand. Join me in welcoming him. He will be talking today on homelands, belonging, and contested loyalties among early Armenian immigrants to America. And obviously, it goes without saying that the topic is quite timely given the context of the world in which we live. And as members of the human species, finding ourselves embarrassed enough to debate and discuss these issues of belonging, place, and mobility in the 21st century, thanks to the particular political climate in which we find ourselves. So, thank you for coming tonight.
Thank you, Seppo. All right, just to lower the bar, I'm not going to engage in contemporary discourses and discussions about belonging, about migration or immigration. But yeah, I will mostly address the end of 19th and early 20th centuries. So first I would like to thank Professor Sebo Aslanyan for inviting me to give a talk on my work in progress. It's a great pleasure to have a chance to finally be on this side of the podium at one of the major centers of Armenian studies nationally and globally, which I believe. The title of my talk is Homelands, Belonging, and Contested Loyalties Among Early Armenian Immigrants in America. In 1928, Shravash Misakyan, one of the prominent leaders of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation and the founder and editor of the Paris-based Harach Daily, wrote in an editorial, and I quote, "If those originating from Harbert, Malatya, or Tigranagert, being very numerous in America, have wealthy compatriotic unions, it does not mean that they should not be benevolent, for example, towards their compatriots originating from Changuilet or Garin, who are fewer in America, who were prosperous yesterday, but today are in need of brotherly support." much broader horizons compared to us. We have arrived at a point where instead of turning our backs to each other, we should look for each other. End of quote. The editorial entitled Compatriotic Wastes, Haydenaksagan Maskumnesh, claimed that the narrow patriotism of the compatriotic societies wasted the moral and material resources of the Armenians, which could otherwise serve the needs of the Armenian people better. Once ubiquitous, especially in America, so much that they raised the concern of some major leaders of Armenian political parties, hometown societies and compatriotic unions among Armenians mostly declined in the course of a generation or two. Most of them practically dissolved and disappeared, and only a few continued, some nominally through the second and third generations, with significantly reduced scope and reach of activities. The purpose of my talk is threefold. By focusing on early Armenian immigrants in America and their hometown societies, first, I will deconstruct the ethnically absolutist discourses of homeland by arguing for the multiple perceptions of homeland among the early Armenian immigrants. Secondly, I will demonstrate how the perceptions of belonging changed over time since the 1890s until the 1930s. And finally, I will argue that in the emerging institutional and discursive spaces in which homeland belonging and Armenianness were negotiated in the American and transnational contexts, hometown societies became less relevant in mobilizing the American-born generations. In the first part of my talk, I will present a theoretical framework briefly, which I'm developing for explaining the immigrant experiences in America between the 1890s and 1930s. I will then focus on the Armenian compatriotic societies, their activities, and the ways in which these loyalties were negotiated within the developing perceptions of Armenianness in the American and transnational contexts in the 1930s. As a diaspora historian who approaches different societies from global and transnational perspectives, one of the questions I'm interested in is how and why transnational and global connections among the generations of dispersed populations become possible historically, especially in the age before internet and advanced communications, such as the late 19th and early 20th centuries. In other words, I'm interested in understanding how dispersed immigrant populations in certain countries developed and maintained durable translocal and transnational networks, which made it possible for their descendants, often offspring of mixed marriages, to stay connected transnationally and develop what many scholars call a diasporic consciousness. Regarding Western societies in general, I posit that the basic principles of democratic constitutions, such as the separation of church and state, freedom of expression, press, assembly, and speech, have created the necessary preconditions for the emergence of spaces for the articulation and maintenance of difference, even if the founding fathers of Western democracies, authors of constitutions and amendments, had not envisioned these consequences. Based on close examination of the French and American cases, I develop an argument that even at the time when French and American state officials and public discourse at large promoted and valorized assimilation, the society still yielded spaces for the articulation, expression, and production of ethnic confessional differences. By spaces of difference, I'm not implying that the French or American state or society were generally homogeneous, and that such spaces should be necessarily juxtaposed against a culturally monolithic French or American background. Rather, by spaces of difference, I refer to institutional and discursive spaces created by immigrant collectivities and maintained by their descendants to preserve and perpetuate something perceived as belonging to a given community's past that is also perceived as not belonging to the local population as a whole, whether those perceptions were accurate or not. By closer look at the immigrant communities and collectivities, my research bears witness to the voices and experiences of the immigrants and their descendants in order to understand how, in the process of integrating into American or other societies, they actively created new forms of belongings. For this reason, I prefer using the concept of negotiations, which implies the existence of two or more parties, both actively involved in the subject matter of negotiations, and both having agency to influence the process and results of negotiations. Building on Stuart Hall's insights on cultural identities as productions, which are never complete and always in progress, process, I argue that these negotiations begin with the settlement of the immigrants in host countries and may continue through their descendants if the first generation is successful enough to establish durable spaces in which they can articulate, recreate, refashion, or in their understanding, preserve and maintain their ethnic traditions. One of the necessary preconditions for the emergence of such spaces is the critical number of immigrants and density of their concentration in certain areas and neighborhoods. Between the 1880s and 1920s, more than 18 million immigrants entered the United States, predominantly from Eastern and Southern Europe and the Middle East. In this period, many immigrants' concentrations emerged in the industrial metropolitan centers of New York, New England, Midwest, as well as in the growing agricultural regions in California. Lower East Side in Manhattan hosted a large community of Eastern European Jews, allowing for the Yiddish language and culture to thrive for more than 30 years. Not too far from it, concentrations of immigrants from Italy, China, and Syria made those parts of Lower Manhattan known as Little Italy, Chinatown, and Little Syria. Armenian immigrants in Worcester, Massachusetts, and Fresno, California, likewise, settled in close neighborhoods, making those parts of the towns known as Little Armenians. Such close settings provided spaces in which the immigrant generation collectively engaged in negotiations of religious, linguistic, racial, and cultural belongings. To simplify or maybe complicate, I'm proposing the following framework. Immigrants arrive into a liminal space. This term, liminality, popularized by anthropologist Victor Turner and recently appropriated by scholars of transnational migration, encapsulates the various concepts that scholars of immigration have used to describe the experiences of in-betweenness, or not here, not there, or multi-locality, and various passages from old to new, which may generate new institutional and discursive forms. Negotiations of religious, cultural, linguistic identities begin in these liminal spaces and, to borrow from Mary Pratt, zones of contact among the various immigrant and American cultures. The success or failure of the initial stage of negotiations, I argue, may lead to three possible outcomes. Cultural assimilation is, of course, one of the major outcomes, which is the near-complete loss of ethnic traits and total acculturation into American society through generations. Here, however, I'm more interested in negotiations which result in the emergence of what I call institutional and discursive spaces of difference. By institutional spaces, I mean hometown societies, religious, cultural, philanthropic, or political organizations established by the immigrant generations. And by discursive spaces, I mean sites of cultural production emerging beyond the immediate immigrant neighborhoods and institutional spaces which connect the immigrants in different localities and transnationally through the means of periodical press. The second phase of negotiations begins in these established institutional and discursive spaces when the immigrant generation is challenged to connect their descendants to these ethnic by essence institutions, organizations, and spaces. In this second phase of negotiations, they have to rethink the compatibility of their ethnic traits with Americanness and find ways in which they and their descendants can be American and stay connected with the established institutional and discursive spaces. It is in this second phase of negotiations, I argue, that some old world traditions are abandoned, some are adjusted to American culture, some are revisited or reconstructed in the American context, resulting in the emergence of mixed or hyphenated representations and identities. In the process of negotiating such ethno-confessional spaces of difference, various institutions may become embedded in the legal, political, and social structure of American society, thus becoming equally American spaces. By the mid-20th century, for example, Judaism and Catholicism and many other less prominent religious practices became as American as Protestantism. The Americanization of these immigrant collectivities within these immigrant spaces of difference does, I argue, involve simultaneous processes of selective inculturation or acquisition of the American culture and selective deculturation or retreat from some traditional identities which result in mixed or hyphenated forms of Americanness. Now let me move on and discuss how the early Armenian immigrants negotiated their cultural identities within and beyond the compatriotic settings and societies. Family and kinship ties and acquaintance networks have been instrumental in minimizing the risks associated with long-distance migration, as Charles Tilly reminds us in his seminal essay, Transplanted Networks. These networks promoted chain migration and resulted in the emergence of immigrant enclaves of various shapes and sizes in the growing industrial and agricultural centers of America. Like many others, early Armenian immigrants from the Ottoman Empire created little Armenian enclaves, usually internally demarcated by hometown affiliations. Be it in Worcester, Fresno, New York, or elsewhere, in places where the late 19th century Armenian immigrants numbered in hundreds or even thousands, the Armenian quarters represented concentrations of family and kinship groups from Harbert, Bitlis, Yozgat, Mush, and many other small towns and villages of central and eastern Anatolia and Cilicia. The minutes of the Armenian American Diocesan National Assembly proceedings dated on February 22, 1910, recorded the following information about the Armenian settlements in the United States. These numbers, of course, were hardly based on any statistics and should be treated as some approximations. But this report and other sources show the importance and prevalence of hometown affiliations and identities among the early Armenian immigrants. Between the 1870s and 1920s, when the immigrants actively created visible communities across America, the American politics, public, and society at large grew increasingly hostile towards these people and communities. Without going into much detail, I will just list some major events that happened in this period to demonstrate the increasingly inhospitable environment in which the immigrant hometown societies, churches, periodical presses, and other organizations were established, operated, and despite everything, many even thrived. On this slide, you can see the anti-immigrant acts, attitudes, and actions in this period. While the Immigration Acts of 1882 and 1917 outright barred certain groups from entering the United States, nativist movements, initially anti-Catholic, grew anti-Semitic and gradually anti-immigrant by the 1920s. This inhospitable environment was exacerbated by widespread discrimination and exclusion, violence and occasional cases of lynching, often regardless of the class, race, ethnicity, and status of the immigrants. Armenians originating from various parts of the Ottoman Empire likewise were treated stereotypically as a single ethno-confessional group wherever they formed some visible communities. Armenians in Fresno, for example, were deprived of purchasing property in certain areas. The standard form of buy and sell agreement act would read, I quote, "Neither said promises nor any part thereof shall be used in any manner whatsoever or occupied by any Negro, Chinese, Japanese, Hindu, Armenian, Asiatic, or native of the Turkish Empire, or descendant of the above-named persons, or anyone not of the white or Caucasian race," end of quote. These kinds of discriminatory regulations forced the Armenians to cluster in particular areas of the town. Yet, despite these discriminatory measures, Armenian quarters provided spaces in which Armenians originating from various parts of the Ottoman Empire could negotiate their communal customs and lifestyles, by establishing compatriotic societies, churches, and other organizations. Emerging in the liminal space, in between their local homelands and American society at large, like many other similar hometown societies founded by Jews, Italians, Syrians, Chinese, and other immigrants, Armenian hometown societies performed a number of social functions. In the American context, with its thriving anti-immigrant sentiments and rhetoric, they created a safety network for their members and incoming compatriots by providing mutual aid accommodations and helping them to find a place to live and work. These societies also became sites of cultural production in which the immigrant generation could speak the same dialect and re-establish communal customs and traditions. Beyond the American context, these immigrant societies also provided spaces in which the immigrant generation could connect with their places of origin, culturally, symbolically, and often practically by involving in transnational activities in support of various projects in their hometowns. Here I will focus on these transnational aspects of the Armenian hometown societies in order to demonstrate the multiple perceptions of homeland and how events happening in their homelands eventually forced these societies to redefine their perceptions of belonging, to negotiate the ways in which they could continue as compatriotic society within the emerging Armenian-American communal and political spaces and discourses. To highlight this process of what I call negotiations of belonging, I propose the following periodization and stages in the development of Armenian compatriotic activism in the United States. The first stage is roughly between the 1890s and 1914, which I call supporting homelands. Most of the compatriotic societies emerged in this period as educational or charitable organizations in support of various projects in their hometowns. First World War opens the second stage, which I call a period of uncertainty. Some compatriotic societies became inactive due to the destruction of communication networks, but many others reorganized as relief organizations in support of their militant compatriots through participating in all Armenian initiatives. The third stage is during the years of armistice between 1918 and 1921, which I call rebuilding and reclaiming homelands. Gradually coming out of the shock of losing many of their family and kin, many compatriotic societies at this stage hoped to reassemble their surviving compatriots in their homelands and rebuild their native villages and towns. Others sent relief and aid to their compatriots who fought against the revived Turkish army in order to reclaim their homelands. This period coincided with the emergence of the Republic of Armenia, but compatriotic societies remained exclusively concerned of the destinies of their surviving compatriots and their hometowns. The fourth stage, which roughly begins after the establishment of the Republic of Turkey in 1923, was the most defining in the activities of the compatriotic societies. I call this rethinking homeland because the establishment of the Republic of Turkey after the Treaty of Lausanne put an end to any hopes of returning to or reclaiming their homelands. In these new conditions, compatriotic societies had to deal with a few practical questions, such as what kind of projects they were to sponsor now that their homelands were destroyed, or where should their compatriots settle after moving out of refugee camps. Pondering around these questions, as I will show, entailed a rethinking of the concept of homeland. Here I would like to focus especially on the first and fourth stages in order to demonstrate the process of negotiating and the changing perceptions of homeland among the early Armenian immigrants within transnational and Armenian-American contexts. The names of the first compatriotic societies in America, as you can see on this slide, are quite telling about their missions. This is just a selection of them. According to estimates, by 1906, there were some 27 such societies in the United States. In this period, compatriotic societies emerged around charitable and educational missions. Their purpose was to send financial aid to their hometown communities for renovating a local church, for building a school, or to help the needy compatriots and orphans. The proliferation of Armenian compatriotic societies coincided with a period when the visionary Armenian intellectuals and leaders of emerging Armenian political parties sought to redefine the Armenian identity and make land and territory the inseparable part of the Armenian identity. In their activities, intellectuals like Rafik, Grigor Artsroni, or political activists like Mkrtich Portugalian, Arpyar Arpyarian, the founders of the Hanchakyan Party or the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, put much effort to educate the Armenians about their homeland, and in the case of the revolutionary parties, to rally them around the struggle for its liberation. For compatriotic societies emerging in the United States, however, the idea of homeland was narrowly defined and remained confined within regional and local boundaries of their native towns or villages. The case of Armenian compatriotic societies of the Kayseri region is very illustrative of this local patriotism. The Sanjak of Kayseri was part of the Ankara Vilayet. The town of Kayseri or the villages of Evereg or Tomarza were never envisioned as part of the Armenian homeland, even in the most aspirational and ambitious political programs of Armenia in the late 19th century. This map actually shows the six Armenian provinces which were considered to be Armenia at the time. And Kayseri is here, and there are two villages here, and this is the Ankara Vilayet, which fell outside Armenia in all kinds of perceptions of Armenia of the time. This is basically this region that I'm talking about, and it was part of the Ankara Vilayet. Yet, for the Armenians originating from these villages and the town of Kayseri, these were their birthplaces, the places where their ancestors were buried, the land of their fathers, their fatherland. This was the native land, the homeland, where their family, relatives, and neighbors lived. Between 1906 and 1914, the Evereg Mesrobian Educational Society, for example, sent about $440 to the Mesrobian school in Evereg. In 1914, they even envisioned to fund a project of building a girls' school in their village. This local patriotism persisted despite the efforts of Armenian political parties in America to extend their influence on these compatriotic societies prior to 1914. During the years of First World War, this is stage two, many societies became inactive due to the disruption of communication networks and the destruction of their compatriots and homelands. In this period of uncertainty, however, many other societies participated in all-Armenian campaigns through the Armenian National Union of America, a short-lived union that came into existence after the merger of Armenian churches and major organizations in March 1917. Closer to the end of the war, compatriotic societies began revisiting their programs and goals to make them more relevant to the post-war conditions. In this stage, which I call rebuilding and reclaiming homelands, some compatriotic societies changed their names to explicitly become reconstruction, Vedashinat societies, and others just embarked on activities extending beyond the original missions of their societies in response to events happening in their homelands. The Treaty of Lausanne concluded between Turkey and the Allied powers in 1923, which recognized the Republic of Turkey, put an end to the Armenian hopes and aspirations of regaining their hometowns. Deprived of homelands, compatriotic societies had to reorient their activities towards the remnants of their surviving compatriots who ended up in various camps and orphanages in the Middle East and Europe, and some even reached to the small Republic of Armenia, which had become a Soviet Republic in 1920. In 1922, the Educational Society of Turin merged with the Reconstruction Union, for example, to create the Compatriotic Union of Turin. Its program declared that the goal of the union was to aid its compatriots both morally and materially, and especially raise funds in support of the orphans. With no Armenians left in old Turin, there was no longer a need to sponsor any projects in their hometowns. The Reconstruction Union of Sebastia and the Union of Armenian Americans from Sebastia joined efforts to establish a rug factory for their compatriots in Aleppo, Syria. Still in a liminal space in America, in which compatriotic societies could afford being insular, inward-looking, and culturally disconnected from the American public spaces, they continued negotiating their identities and belonging exclusively within Armenian institutional and discursive spaces. The Sovietization of Armenia and the expulsion of the Armenia's former leaders in 1921 transferred the enmity and struggles between the incumbent Bolshevik and the former Armenian governments into the diaspora. This is a map of Soviet Armenia, which basically excluded most of the places from which these compatriots were originated in America. These tensions and struggles between the supporters of Soviet Armenia and the Armenian government in exile and their supporters, mostly the affiliates of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, gradually penetrated into the affairs of the compatriotic societies. Among other political disagreements, the government of Soviet Armenia and the elite supporting them and the former government of the Republic of Armenia promoted and disseminated two competing discourses on Armenian homeland in the 20s and 30s. Without going into much detail here, I will briefly address these discourses as they influenced the programs and activities of the compatriotic societies in the fourth stage, which I call Rethinking Homeland. After coming to power, the Bolshevik government in Armenia created the Committee for Aid to Armenia in 1921. In less than a decade, the committee created dozens of chapters in America, France, and some other countries. In rhetoric and actions, the committee promoted Soviet Armenia as the homeland of all Armenian workers. The project of assembling the Armenian genocide survivors in Soviet Armenia, therefore, was publicized as repatriation, despite the fact that the surviving Armenians had not been displaced from this part of Armenia. The fiercest opponents of the Bolshevik regime in Armenia, the former leaders of the Republic of Armenia, on the other hand, launched an anti-Soviet campaign among the dispersed Armenians through their media and organizational networks. In their discourse, the independence and unity of Armenia remained as goals to be achieved in future. In the meanwhile, communities in exile had to organize locally, engage in the preservation of their identities, and mobilize against the Soviet expansion among Armenians. These competing discourses on Armenian homeland and conflicting political aspirations of the hostile factions often translated into violent clashes between the supporters and opponents of Soviet Armenia. Both political factions acknowledged the dominance of compatriotic affiliations among scattered Armenian masses and sought to expand their influence over these heterogeneous masses of people with divergent interests and activities. Upon his return to Soviet Armenia from a year-long tour among Armenian communities in France and America, Gaden Mikhailyan, the head of the Committee for Aid to Armenia delegation, published an extensive report on compatriotic activism in 1928. The delegation recorded about 130 compatriotic societies in the United States alone. Acknowledging the potential of these organizations, Mikhailyan proposed that the smaller compatriotic societies of various towns and villages should merge in larger regional unions in order to make their contributions to the rebuilding of Soviet Armenia more effective. While the representatives of the committee sought to channel the compatriotic efforts to Soviet Armenia, their opponents, the ARF leadership, sought to erase compatriotic differences and unite the Armenian masses around all Armenian concerns. The leadership of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation thought of the compatriotic societies as useless weeds, wasting the material and moral resources of the nation. The passage I quoted in the beginning of my talk by Shavash Misakyan represented this perspective. Misakyan was a member of the ARF Bureau at the time, the highest executive body of the party, as he expressed against the divergent and wasteful efforts of the compatriotic societies and called for developing broader perspectives. In view of such tensions and conflicts, many compatriotic societies initially attempted to remain neutral towards the Armenian political parties and factions. Neutrality, however, was impossible to preserve as both the Committee for Aid to Armenia and the ERF aspired to bring these societies under their influence. The very practical questions that the compatriotic societies had to deal with, on the other hand, ultimately put them into cooperation with one or the other faction. Genuinely concerned of the fate of their compatriots in various refugee camps in the Middle East and Europe, among others, compatriotic societies had to deal with two questions, as I mentioned. What kind of projects they were to sponsor now that their hometowns were destroyed and the return of their surviving compatriots was impossible? And where should their compatriots settle after moving out of camps and orphanages? Political conditions offered two alternatives. Compatriotic societies could either support projects of resettling their compatriots in Soviet Armenia, or they could focus exclusively on the needs of their surviving compatriots and orphans in the Middle East and elsewhere outside Soviet Armenia. In search for responses to these questions, compatriotic societies had to rethink the concept of homeland and renegotiate their belongings. The rethinking, however, involved some ambivalence. On the one hand, compatriotic societies became agencies of nurturing and cultivating memory through publishing memorials and volumes on the geography, topology, climate, history of their villages, towns, and regions, which also included detailed biographies of most notable compatriots. But on the other hand, they gradually evolved in the dissemination of the competing political discourses on Armenian homeland and became agencies of constructing and promoting Armenia, whether the Soviet Republic or the aspirational independent and united Armenia. In their discourses, either they began to emphasize the rebirth and reconstruction of their native communities in the new homeland, Soviet Armenia, or they put efforts to reassemble their compatriots in the Middle East, hoping that someday their native villages will be reclaimed once the larger Armenia was restored, a project which was more in line with the ideology of the ERF. Some compatriotic societies entered this stage of rethinking without major internal clashes. For many others, however, this process led to internal disagreements, clashes, and schisms. In this period of rethinking, many compatriotic societies began also publishing periodicals, the role of which in the construction of identities has been convincingly argued by many scholars of nationalism. I will discuss here the example of Compatriotic Union of Yurin, which experienced an internal schism in the 1930s in the process of rethinking and negotiating homeland. Until up to the 1930s, the Compatriotic Union of Yurin, which emerged from the merger of the educational and reconstructionist societies of Yurin in 1922, had predominantly engaged in local projects, organized chapters in different places in America, created a women's council, a youth union, and occasionally raised funds in support of the needy compatriots in the Middle East and elsewhere. The possible construction of new Yurin in Soviet Armenia had been a matter of discussion in several conventions, but the Executive Council did not take any action for its implementation. A report published in the first issue of Yurin Nehush, Memory of Yurin, in November 1930, condemned the Executive Council for its reluctance on this matter. Yurin Nehush was a periodical affiliated with the New York chapter of the Union, whose editor and contributors supported the construction of new Yurin in Soviet Armenia. Internal tensions surfaced in 1931 when a small faction separated and established the Union of New Yurin, Nor Yurin Miusun, in New York. It reunited with the New York chapter in 1933, but the tensions continued. Yurin Nehush took an explicit pro-Soviet Armenia stand and began propagating it as the new homeland of Armenians. In an article published in 1933, entitled National Rebirth and Compatriotic Unions, Nation, Homeland, and Political Parties, one of the members of the editorial board asserted, And I quote, "From now on, the Armenian people have to embark on serious construction work. The current condition of the Renaissance Soviet Armenia require us to create a national cooperation in order to complete that work in unity and collectively. Our national interests demand repatriation to homeland and reconstruction." End of quote. You can see the emphasis on certain words in the Armenian text, and I have the translation of those words here in English. The article went on to condemn the Armenian political factions opposing the Soviet regime in Armenia. I quote, "Dry and meaningless patriotism, fantasy nationalism inspired by partisan prejudices never lead to construction. We should put an end to such populist activities. We're full of the achievements of certain short-sighted political activists towards national salvation. We should stop the meaningless, stubborn, and destructive struggles against our homeland, the liberty and the founding of which they assure has been their gift to this nation, acquired for an extremely expensive price. That legacy, which is bestowed upon us, which they unfortunately could not preserve and maintain, is in need of huge work and construction today. Therefore, they need to leave these people alone so that they are not suspicious and confused about their homeland, which is in need of care." End of quote. Without an explicit reference to any political faction, this was an implicit criticism of the policies of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation. Similar articles abundant in the pages of North Sebastia, the periodical of the Old Sebastian Union as well, were attempts to redefine the homeland among their compatriots, to substitute the old with the new one, the revived Armenia, which offered more tangible perspectives for the re-establishment and rebirth of their communities in this new homeland. This new course of the Compatriotic Union of Turin marginalized the internal opponents in the 1930s. The program and goals of the Union also underwent significant revisions in the 30s, reflecting this change. The same issue of Yuri Nehush published a draft of the proposed bylaws. These bylaws did not make any direct reference to Soviet Armenia, but very mildly stated in the section on activities, I quote, "In order to make our national existence durable, the Union should put effort to assemble our compatriots of Yuri in various diasporic communities in our mother homeland, within the borders of Armenia, and we should establish our township there." This was published in the last issue of Yuri Nehush in August 1933. 3 years later, the new bylaws adopted by the annual convention of the Compatriotic Union of Yuri in February 1936 were quite assertive about this major goal, I quote, "To construct new Yuri in Soviet Armenia, and to assemble the compatriots of Yurin living abroad there," end of quote. These new bylaws also introduced an article on organizational discipline, which allowed local chapters to expel any of their members by the majority of votes. By this time, the Union came under the domination of the faction supporting the construction project in Soviet Armenia. The assassination of Archbishop Levon Turian, the primate of the Armenian Church, in 1933 by 6 members of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation further exacerbated the internal tensions within compatriotic unions in the 30s. The sympathizers of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, regardless of whether they justified or condemned the killing, were excluded from many Armenian churches, organizations, and societies. This incident facilitated the schisms within many compatriotic societies. Almost in parallel to the split of the Compatriotic Union of Turin, unions of Sebastia, Aintab, Kyrgyz, Kharbet, and other places also split in the 1930s. The rival faction would usually establish a parallel compatriotic society, often claiming the same name. In the 1930s, the reorganizing compatriotic societies and unions reached to the point when the future of their village or town was seen as connected to the destiny of Armenia, whether the Soviet Republic or the project of Armenia to be achieved in future. However, even if compatriotic societies subscribed to and advocated for the prevailing discourses on homeland they never completely abandon the attachment to their native homelands. Even those who sponsored projects in Soviet Armenia still preserve this attachment to their old homeland. Old and new existing in dialectical dichotomy, the former as memory, as a place of longing and belonging, the latter symbolizing the rebirth, continuity, and the future. As an expression of this, many compatriotic societies commissioned the publication of volumes on the geography, topology, education, language, history, and demography of their villages and towns, alongside sponsoring projects for the re-establishment of their compatriots in Soviet Armenia or in the Middle East. On this slide, you can see the names of some compatriotic societies which embarked on or projected constructing villages or towns in Soviet Armenia. In the long run, however, compatriotic societies were unable to maintain extensive transnational activism and organization. Both the social political context in America and the ongoing struggles between the Armenian political factions transnationally were not conducive for the persistence of compatriotic affiliations. For the American-born generations who were educated in American schools and sought to advance in American society, compatriotic affiliations were no longer instrumental in the negotiations of their identities. Those who remained connected with Armenian churches or other Armenian organizations were influenced by the competing discourses of Armenianness beyond narrower compatriotic affiliations. In the ongoing negotiations of Armenianness in the American context, the Armenian institutional and discursive spaces emerging around the Armenian churches, political and other organizations proved to be more durable, whereas primary identifications with compatriotic communities faded with the successive generations. To conclude, my intention throughout this talk was to complicate the perceptions of homeland and belonging among the early Armenian immigrants in America. By analyzing the programs and activities of some Armenian compatriotic societies in the United States between the 1890s and 1930s, I argued, first of all, that despite the overall discriminatory and anti-immigrant rhetoric and sentiments across the country, Armenians and other immigrants established societies, religious, cultural, political, and charitable organizations in which they could exclusively engage in matters of their old world universe. In these liminal spaces in between old and new worlds, they could afford being insular, inward-looking, remain culturally and linguistically disconnected from wider American society. As the immigrants crossed these liminal spaces and integrated into American society, they had to renegotiate the compatibility of these organizations and identities with Americanness and with contested perceptions of Armenianness within emerging Armenian-American spaces. If in the first stage local patriotism expressed in emotional attachments to native villages and towns were dominant among the diverse groups of Armenian immigrants, in the second and subsequent stages of negotiations they gradually faded. After their hometowns were destroyed and the return became impossible, these hometown societies had to rethink their goals, programs, and activism. In this process, they had to engage in the prevailing discourses of Armenianness as they emerged in the institutional and discursive spaces provided by Armenian churches, political, and other organizations. If in the long run, Armenian churches, political, and some other old Armenian initiatives were more successful in negotiating their activities and became embedded in the legal, political, and social structure of the American society, hometown affiliations became less relevant in the negotiations of Armenianness in the American transnational and diasporic context. Thank you.
We have about 25 minutes to host questions. Do you want to take the questions yourself, Brian?
Sure, I'll be happy to. Yes,
Daniel. Thanks very much, Brian. I wanted to ask about I wanted to speak about the origins of these territorialized identities. I asked for a specific reason. Your talk made me think that most often when we read about territorialized identities, the idea that I'm part of a certain group and that this group is tied to a certain territory, we read about that from the perspective of in your period, the rise of nationalism. Also, your talk was interesting because these compatriotic unions, the idea of belonging to a certain group, but more specifically belonging to a specific Ottoman-Armenian group and wanting to open schools, for instance, in the Ottoman-Armenian provinces, is also a phenomenon that goes, either it originates with or it goes parallel with the rise of kind of the nation form, national thinking, the idea that Armenians need Armenians have education and so on. I wonder if you could speak about the origins of this trans-territorial thinking, because what you described seems to go against that. It seems to say that, you argue specifically that this is before the thinking is becoming nationalized.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's a good point. Actually, I think of this period as you know, simultaneous processes. On the one hand, there is this current which really aspires to territorialize Armenian identity and attach it to certain territory, which is the intellectuals, mostly from Eastern Armenia, but later from... Well, also, I find this also in Kherimian very much, so I think... Well, that's. I don't want to go into much there, but yeah, Kherimian is very, very, very important in this regard. But there is also the tendency among ordinary Armenians to just think about the localities that they're coming from, which is not very much territorialized, but because of their connections with spaces from which they're coming from, so they're not thinking about this. Territory as being necessarily the most important defining character of their identity, but they feel kind of affinity, they feel belonging to that place because simply their ancestors are buried there. They have neighbors who still live there, they have friends, they have family who still live there. So once they are dispersed, it's becoming more easier for these compatriots to argue for Soviet Armenia as the new homeland, right? So that territorial attachment kind of seems to disappear at that time, but yet it's still there. That's why I'm mentioning about the ambivalence. So there's this, on the one hand, they create these memorials, the books and everything about their local villages and towns, but on the other hand, they promote this idea of new homeland. Or some are really not certain what is happening and what's going to happen. But yeah, I'm not sure if I answered, but I see this as two processes. One is territorializing, the other is not much concerned with territory, but just attachment.
Yeah, I may laugh on that.
Yes.
I was curious as to what your impression is on how nationalized these villages were in the old country. Before making the transition to the States. One of the things I'm thinking about here, this is of course literature, but nevertheless I think it's relating to reality on the ground, is something like Kogan Panchuni.
Yeah.
Very significant.
Yes.
The teacher who is going to come from Constantinople is from the Tiyatsiala Yemchun.
Yes.
And obviously, what he's going to be studying is nationalism.
Yes.
And also a Panchuni, which is a representation and representative of the Revolutionary Party, is against that, and therefore has him stoned and chased away before he gets there. The presumption is that the villagers themselves are not only pre-revolutionary, but pre-national. And so I wonder how far you see this situation as being significantly widespread in those original villages and small towns and so on, from which the people are coming and settling, and therefore, of course, their formation is within that sort of background.
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I didn't have chance to study much that, but from what I've seen is that some of the members of these compatriot societies are coming from these backgrounds, which are more educated, more kind of influenced by these new ideas of, you know, nationhood, territory, etc., and inspired by some revolutionary ideologies. But in the first stages, usually they cannot influence the whatever is going on within the unions. And part of it, I think, has to do with the identities of the newcomers. Who were the newcomers? The first Armenians who came to this country were Protestants, just seeking for work or education, and that's all. They were not revolutionaries. They had nothing to do with these new emerging concepts of, you know, the national and territorial identities. They just came here for work and education. And when they could collect some money, they would think about, you know, sponsoring some projects back in their home countries. So, and there is also the other parallels thing also, that first compatriotic societies emerged in Constantinople, actually. Those are created by migrants who are coming from provinces. They get together to send money back to their provinces to fund some local projects. So it's kind of happening within the empire as well. That's late 19th century.
Like 1890s?
I think a little earlier than that, yes. Yes. Well, the resources that I've consulted are mostly from about American compatriotic societies, but I've seen them making references to the society that exists in Polis, and they're connected with the society in Polis, and I couldn't find much about the societies which were based in Polis and operated locally, kind of within the imperial boundaries. But yeah, that's something I would probably think about in future.
It's just a little continuation of that question.
Yes.
Focused on a specific real identity. Fatherland, Italy, or homeland, or identity always meant, obviously, it was the whole country, or whether represented territorially the nation, but the dominant meaning was the village, or the place you lived, or, as you said, where your ancestors were buried. And obviously we see the 19th century or an appropriation by nationalists of this source of the word hegemony for the, you know, bigger construction that is a country. What do you see, what do you observe in the texts you have read of the compatriotic unions and their annals? How do they use hegemony? What's the dominant meaning of hegemony from the village, town, or that big construction?
Well, they use hegemony, ashkhad, hegemony, yergir, different things. Basically, hegemony is very common. Hegemonic, I haven't seen much hegemonic, plural. Hegemony, like native, in that sense. But I wanted to go back to that meaning of hegemonic, which is, I see in the writings of Hrimian a lot about hegemonic, in which he tries to actually promote this idea that Hellenic is much larger, much bigger than just these localities. In fact, when I was reading Artvi Vaspuragam by Hrimian, I came across some articles by Cervantesian, who was at the time the student of Hrimian. And Cervantesian, I couldn't stop by thinking about, you know, how much Cervantesian's perspective was connected to the Shavash Nisagyan quote that I wrote. He wrote at the time in the 1860s that, you know, the Garnetsi and the Bitlisti think they are different people. They have local patriotism, and the Garnetsi thinks if he has done things for his own people in Garin, then that there ends his patriotism. This article is entitled Hayrena Sirutsun, or something like that. So it's very interesting that the discourse of hegemonic already being kind of there in the 1860s in the writings of Hrimian. So, but
my question was about the penetration of that change.
That happens after 1923. Well, in two competitor societies, because now they're forced to think about, okay, what we're doing now. Before that, I don't see them engaging in this discussion about what is the real meaning of hegemonic and what is our hegemonic. Yeah.
Actually, on the question of hegemonic, it might be of interest for some to know here that as far as the Julfan communities concerned, in Julfa and Isfahan, in the 1740s, after the collapse of both Nijulfa, it's fairly common to come across in letters description of Isfahan and Julfa as the hegemonic.
Yeah.
And they're not talking about the homeland as an art or historic Armenia, they're talking about the relationship to the place where their graves are, where they grew up, where they were born, etc., etc. So, and it becomes much more, I guess, it becomes nationalized in the 20th century, perhaps, maybe
late 19th and early 20th.
On that note, I had a couple of questions. One was, one has to do with terminology. Terminological questions. The first one is, in your presentation, which was quite interesting in its detail and attention to specific things, you mentioned inculturation and deculturation.
Yes.
But what I thought was missing, and maybe it's not, and I'd like you to comment on that, is the concept of transculturation, which, as you might know, was developed by Ortiz.
Yeah.
I forget his first name, an anthropologist of Cuban origin who wrote a famous book in 1952 called Cuban Counterpoint, and he precisely wanted to address this lack or this asymmetry between acculturation and deculturation.
Yeah.
So he developed this concept of transculturation to signify the creative hybridization of identities.
Yes.
Where
yes.
identities are actually liminal, where they, the liminal interstitial space where a people's sense of belonging and sense of is composed of, at the very least, two or three or multiple components.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if that has a place in your research and if it does, and why, why not? The second question is also terminological, and that is, and I may be completely off here, some of these Armenians that you address who have settled in this country and formed patriotic unions, in the late, let's say, 19th century, maybe early 20th century, particularly in the 20s, 21, after Sovietization, did they at all describe themselves as a Skyuk, a diaspora, a galut, or are these concepts like the larger notion of imagined communities or the nation much, much later? When is the first attested use of Skyuk or diaspora for these people? And lastly, if you have time, what kinds of papers did these people use in order to come here as migrants? Obviously, I'm trying to connect this to current day discussions as well. Anytime there's mobility through and across liminal spaces, you need to have paper instruments. You need to have passports, you need to have visas, you need to have letters of recommendation, or some variety of paper instruments. So, are these passports, were they traveling, those who could have them, were they traveling with Ottoman passports, 1869, post-1869? Or what, if you could comment on that.
Okay, all right. Thank you. Those were good questions. Yeah, I've some notes here. All right, transculturation. So, I've read about this concept I came across in my reading of international and transnational migrations a lot. One thing that I decided not to use in this specific context, I use it elsewhere, but not in this context, because here I wanted to emphasize exactly the process of, you know, how you negotiate between these two identities, which you trying to find a solution to, being in America, which is the overarching Americanness, as you imagine it, and your ethnicness, which you have. So, the direction forward, which is how you become an American, is a process of inculturation in which you're trying to borrow some things which you think will make you American, and then a process of leaving something which you think is actually not compatible with you being American. So these two processes, in order to emphasize these two processes, I preferred using these two concepts, inculturation and deculturation. That's why I'm not using transculturation, but I'm using it in another context,
but
not in this context.
That implies that these identities, Americanness or Armenians, are discrete, fairly bounded things, and they're not.
They're not.
Porous with porous frontiers.
But in their minds, they are. So I'm trying to bring the immigrant perspective. In their minds, they are. Whatever they bring is distinct from whatever is here. That's why I say whatever they imagined as Americanness, because it's in reality Americanness, there is no one American way. There are many ways to be American. But in their minds, there is a certain way to be an American. And that might include something. I had a talk like a month ago at Michigan, and I was talking about negotiating religion, language, race, and belonging among early immigrants. So, for example, they quickly realized that they can be whatever they want in terms of religion in America. That's totally compatible with Americanness. They also quickly realized that, you know, in order to be American, they have to speak English, and speaking Armenian is totally incompatible with Americanness. You cannot survive by only speaking Armenian. That's what they have to abandon, language. But they realize that they can be white, so they start negotiating whiteness as well, and there is in fact a case of four Armenians petitioning the denial of their naturalization application at the court in Massachusetts, which they're basically trying to claim that they're white in order to become citizens. And eventually they're successful. They don't change their color, of course. Whiteness is being extended to include Armenians as well. So that's what I'm trying to emphasize, that there is the perception of Americanness, and there is the perception of their old ethnicness, and they're trying to find a solution between these two and how they can create something which is compatible in the American context. That's why I'm using these two different things instead of
just theorizing. I guess it comes down to the issue of ethnic versus ethic, whether you're describing something from the perspective of the local actors themselves or as a social scientist looking from the outside.
Well, yeah, there is always tension between ethnic and ethic, so...
They're linked with boundaries.
Yeah.
Identities are not really fixed.
Yeah.
So in that sense, transculturation could be used.
Yeah, I agree. Alright, regarding next question, I don't see any evidence they're using diaspora at this period, 1921, 1922. I think it comes much later. I haven't been able to find out when was the first time that Armenians used diaspora.
Or Spurk.
But I know that, was it Odian? He has a novel or something, Diaspora, or... Well, I came across some literature in which people actually talk about diaspora, Spurk. They use the word Spurk, but I don't see these concepts used in by these compatriotic societies of this time. So I'm not sure. It might be a latecomer or maybe early, but it's not in this period in their programs or any of their writings. Papers, what papers they used to come here? They have some official papers from Ottoman Empire. I know in the case of France, for example, when they came to France, refugees, in 1920s, early 1924 actually, France... they adopted a law which actually required that all immigrants should have papers from their old countries. Now, Turkey was a republic and the Ottoman Empire did not exist, and these Armenians could either claim papers from Turkey or from Soviet Union. They didn't have any papers as refugees who came to France. So this is how they actually became eligible for apartheid status, Nelson documents, which basically gave them some status of being stateless, but they didn't have any documents. For example, the refugees, the genocide survivors, the early newcomers to America, I think they had some kind of documents. I didn't see any documents. I was not paying attention to that part, so I haven't come across any documents. But I know that in order to get citizenship, well, I already mentioned that they had to go through these litigation processes. I saw only one case of litigation by four Armenians, but I assume there might be some more. And this is how they became eligible for becoming citizens in this country.
Yeah. Well, regarding these papers, the League of Nations provided some papers to refugees.
Yeah.
And Nelson, Richard Nelson was the head of that, and it's known as Nelson Passport.
Yeah.
And that was part of papers.
Yeah, this was in Europe.
Well, that's only for Europe.
That's only Europe, yes.
In the 1880s or 90s, they must some of the people who came here must have had part of the past.
Yeah, that's what I assume.
Because the past was 69.
Yes, that's what I assume. So I don't know. Haven't seen any of my passports. Okay, correct.
So in your presentation, you focus mostly on exclusively on societies, but presumably the societies do not embrace the entirety of their needy population. On top of that, political parties or these organizations that have been they do not represent the views of the masses. They rather seek to impose certain ideology on them by propagating certain ideas. So we can claim, or assume, or hypothesize that there was a large number of Armenians who did not seek to identify themselves with their past world, who were preoccupied rather with local issues that they were not, sometimes they could not even be Armenian related. Until the 20s, they were considered an inferior race. They were not whites, and they were experiencing all kinds of constraints with that regard. So they could possibly start to engage with local activities and cut off their past. So that may not be necessarily representative of what Armenians, how Armenians saw themselves, or what kind of images of self, of America, or of their past were actually circulating or were part of the discourse at the time. So how representative these views or these societies were back then amongst their Armenians of the United States?
Yeah, that's a good question. So they were quite popular, I would say. I mean, the report that was published in 1928 recorded about 130 such organizations. So I think these organizations were as close to the masses as possible. And rather than imposing anything on the masses, they were actually mass initiatives. They came around because masses who already lived in these competitive settings, they decided to formalize their activities to pay membership dues in order to collect some money and donate to some projects, devote to some projects. So those who chose not to involve, they assimilated, so I don't know what happened to them. Many of them just disappeared. And so I cannot tell if these were representative, but I would say they were quite prevalent among the first generation, among the immigrant generations. And it's not only an Armenian phenomenon, or it's not exclusively Armenian phenomenon. This kind of societies existed among the Jews, the Chinese, the Italians, and everyone, because the immigrants tended to live in close neighborhoods for many reasons, but the major reason being the overall inhospitable environment in this country. Yes.
And I think just depending on what you said about that previous question, it's very curious. You mentioned several times the issues of the integration of these communities into the U.S.
Yes.
But you did refer to that more directly.
Yes.
I know that later on, a number of Armenian organizations, groups, and so on, did open reading rooms and things like that.
Yes.
They had actual English classes themselves.
Yes.
So here we're talking more about self-help.
Yes.
You were largely focused on gathering funds, etc.
Yes.
To be extended in the old homeland, etc. I was very curious, so already at this period, was there any sort of move along these lines, I mean, in terms of self-help for these various groups in order more easily to integrate into American life,
yeah.
So that they had that sort of component as well. And so what form would that have taken place?
Yeah. I have not seen these societies being involved in this kind of activities, in helping their members to Americanize. But I've seen other initiatives, mostly by Protestant Armenians and by the AGBU, who would publish, who would translate American citizenship requirements, for example, in Armenian language and disseminate among Armenians on how to acquire citizenship in America, or they would translate the Constitution of America to disseminate among Armenians to make them connected and to learn actually about America. And they would, yes, organize English classes for the immigrants. But these were not these societies. So these were more all Armenian, what I call, organizations like the AGPU or the Protestants. Initially, the Apostolic Armenian community was not involved in this kind of activities. They were exclusively concerned about churches, about maintaining. It's only in the 1930s when Durian, this Archbishop Durian, became the primate of the church. It is only in the 1930s that he actually endorses the publication of bilingual Armenian prayer books, English and Armenian. Before then, the church doesn't use any English in the services. So, yeah, not these societies, but there is initiatives to Americanize Armenian. Yes?
I'm first generation compatriot of Richard Hohenes, and he and I were in the same group.
Yeah.
And I saw the my folks were from Arafir and Hafir. Okay. And they were in their own little groups, almost like, you know, villages. And they instilled in me a responsibility to keep the culture going in the land of the Ogars. Now, and the groups that I saw, I was in Massachusetts in the 50s and came to California. I saw these little unions subsidizing the songs of their villages and so on, with musical artists in the United States. A friend of mine, Guy Chikurian, his father, he put out a number of records, 78 RPM. And that was strong. But then I also saw with the Soviet Union using, this is my impression, the Soviet Union using the Armenianness and all that as a way of furthering the Soviet Union's goals.
Yeah.
Splitting the societies that should have come together.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. While I was a student here at UCLA, shortly after we drove the Indians out of here, I got together with children from the Soviet side, and we started a student-based non-political group. Okay. Now, I saw a lot of that division starting to dissolve once the Republic of Armenia, Soviet Armenia, disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And that division, especially in the division in the church, started to dissolve. But mm-hmm. we're still, I think, in a transition. So you talked about the function of these organizations here. That function being transferred by different organizations.
Yeah.
Okay? Mm-hmm. And we're still, I still sense problems between IANs and YANs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
Starting to dissolve because now Armenia is really looking, you know, the Turkish Armenians, the Anatolian Armenians, starting to get together with Russian Armenians and say, okay, let's reunite.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned toward the end of your presentation, which I'd like to get a copy of that. I started to see that it's becoming less divisive based on political things, and there's enough political intrigue going on in Armenia now.
Yeah.
To replace that. So the function of maintaining the culture and what institutions keep that going is interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see where I had no idea of the approach that you just presented here, and it opens up a lot of new doors.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Daniel, you had a question?
Yeah, I was trying to check my notes in the meantime. I was surprised that you were able to separate out the completion unions from the political organizations. I can't remember now, I should know, I suppose. I was interested, I researched this stuff. So this is a very dear topic to my heart because this is the first thing that I worked on when I was still an undergrad, these sorts of things. My question comes from here. So from what I know, from the 1890s already, you have ARF and Hunchak chapters in the U.S. You can correct me if I'm wrong. So they're there very early on, alongside these guys. Right?
Yes.
How is it that their histories can be kept distinct? Is that a methodological thing, or is that because the groups really were, I mean, they didn't interact, there was no overlap there?
That's a very good question. So the way I'm doing is, you know, when I read their programs or activities before the 20s, I don't see much influence by revolutionary parties. So I just assume that either they are self-consciously distancing from the revolutionary ideologies or they don't have simply members. So the second seems to be more plausible because, yes, the ARF and Hunchakians have chapters in the U.S., but they are not as extensive as they would become later on, after the 20s. And, it is interesting that when I first read about the American Armenian diaspora, first, the striking part of it is the conflict around the church and how church split became this important event that separated these communities and crystallized. But it's usually viewed from top down, like leaders have conflicts and then communities suddenly separate. But this actually provides a perspective which is a bottom up. You actually look at the people and how those conflicts influence their decisions and their lives. So in the early on, I don't see them much involved in the politics. But later on, in the 20s, and especially in the 30s, they become much more involved. So that's actually, it's from my resources that I could separate this history from the history of revolutionary parties.
There's a very interesting case of what you were telling. You know, most Confederate unions publish their Madians.
Yes.
One of the most extensive is CIS Madian, both CIS.
Yeah.
And the union was led by Tashmak Zagans. And the other ones, they commissioned the Hunchakian.
Yeah.
And they did a very serious job. So.
Yeah.
But the thing is, finished. The print is out. You're talking about 1,300 pages.
Yeah.
Large, a lot of money spent on it, and the party or the people from Tashkent are saying no, we don't like this. There's not enough campus.
Yeah.
It's not distributed.
Yeah.
No distribution is ever
informed
of that. So every...
When was it published?
Copy of that, like it's from the author, could get some, friends of friends could get some.
Yeah. When was it published?
I think it was in the 30s, 40s?
40s, 50s?
50s,
it should be, it should be later on. Well, I have similar examples. During my interviews, it came a lot. Not a lot, because I haven't been able to interview many members of Confederate society because simply there are not many. So in one of my interviews, the author of the Chok Marzban book, which was published in 2006, Minas Kojayan, he told me that, you know, when we have a meeting, everyone comes, they put aside their political affiliations or whatever. During the meeting, we don't discuss politics. It's all about our village, but it's too, late 20th century, so it's not early late 19th century. So these are different contexts. Yeah, but and he mentioned that the commissioner for this volume was Darshana, while the author himself was an AGBU Ramgavar. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. Before I let you go, we have another talk coming up on the 2nd of March with some deep continuities in terms of themes, but going back in history to the early modern period. And it's a talk by Michael Piper, also from Michigan, a very smart guy, who's going to be talking on the image of the gharib, you know, in the pre-modern Mediterranean, for the fact that I mean, but also the economy. So I hope to see some of you there at least, and thank you again for coming.
You got your regular...
Yes, if you're on that list, you should be able to get it.